Ms. Rebell.
Good morning. I want to begin by putting to rest the jurisdictional issue that was raised by the disappointed intervener in this case. We're on appeal here from a consent judgment entered under Rule 68. And there's no question that the Sims reserved the right to appeal the question of the setting aside of the default judgment in this case, or the default in this case. The parties are deeply and unalterably adverse on that issue. Cases where consent judgments were deemed non-final for appellate jurisdiction purposes generally fall into two categories. One is where there's some lurking claim that has been dismissed without prejudice below and is going to come back and haunt the proceeding later. That's not this case. And the second is where there's been no liability finding at all below, and the parties and sometimes the court do an end run around this to get to the appellate court. And that's not this case either. There was a default below. The default, had it remained in place, would have been a conclusive determination on liability. So I see no impediment to this court's appellate jurisdiction here. I think that the issue that this court has to face in this case, and what we're asking the court to hold explicitly, is that a litigant is bound by the litigation conduct of its insurer. And that's a question of law that we believe should be determined de novo. We would also ask this court to hold that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court below not to consider the conduct of the insurer who controls the litigation in determining whether a defendant meets a good cause standard under Rule 55. In this case,
in considering this question of default, may we consider the settlement agreement as affecting the decision on default?
May you consider the settlement agreement? You can certainly consider the settlement agreement for any purpose that you would like, Your Honor.
Well, a settlement agreement, I think, may affect the consequences of the default. Is that correct?
It will affect what ultimately the parties do. I mean, under the settlement agreement, the parties have agreed that if this court reverses and the district court enters damages in this case, the plaintiffs, Daniel and Andrea Sims, are not going to execute the judgment against EGA products. So there really is no EGA's argument that it will be forced into bankruptcy by this decision is really not there.
Well, it imposes the burden of the default on a different party, does it? Right?
Well, that party can litigate that issue if and when we get to that point.
Well, we're considering it now, though. My question is, should we consider the operation of the settlement agreement in connection with deciding how the default issue ought to be decided?
I think not, Your Honor. I think that at most where that should come into play is in deciding whether the intervener ends up involved in this case in the court below. And I frankly think I'm not at all clear what the intervener would do in the court below. As far as I can tell from the briefs, the intervener's primary hope in this case was to avoid this court ever getting hearing the case. But frankly, I think that at this point what this court should do is reverse, let the district court determine the damages issue, and then let the settlement agreement play out in the way that the parties have arranged.
Returning to the question of appellate jurisdiction, though, isn't there a provision in the settlement agreement by which litigation could be revived even though we affirm? And doesn't that go to the question of whether there's a final judgment or not?
I don't see that in the settlement agreement. If this court affirms, what I see the settlement agreement doing is ending the litigation altogether.
Well, there is a provision, as I recall, I haven't got it right in front of me, of the settlement agreement, which if the condition is not met, there will be subsequent litigation in the trial court.
Excuse me, Your Honor. There is a provision in the settlement agreement that says, that purports to say, that if this court never reaches the merits, and presumably...
Yeah, that's the one I have in mind.
Right. Presumably what the court, what the parties are imagining there is if the court determines there's no...
If that condition is not met, can't we have subsequent litigation in the district court?
I don't see it. I see two possible outcomes. If the court reverses, then it goes back to for a determination of damages. If the court affirms, the litigation is over. If the court never reaches the merits because it determines there's no appellate jurisdiction, presumably it has done so because it doesn't believe there's a final judgment below. Alternatively, the parties can't agree among themselves that a judgment is null and void. What the parties could do is agree to go back and file a Rule 60 motion to undo the judgment, but that would take judicial action. So no, and the fact that a judgment may be subject at some point to a Rule 60 motion doesn't render it non-final. So I really don't see litigation at the district court level beyond a damages determination. Once we look at what the district court did in this case, really I think the rule that the district court used is unsupportable. The wording of the holding in this case, I think, is instructive. The court said, under the narrow facts of this case, EGA's failure to actively monitor the progress of litigation, while certainly less than perfect conduct, is not necessarily inexcusable. And I think it's clear from what the district court said in its opinion that it's...
Counsel, let me put the question this way. Why is it an abuse of discretion for the district judge to use the principle that the punishment must fit the crime? If the error or misconduct in this case is fundamentally harmless, why is a $30 million judgment the right response? Now, we've said many times, for example, that district courts shouldn't enter default when lawyers don't show up for a status conference or when the plaintiff skips out on one deposition or something of that sort. There are all sorts of delicts that happen in litigation where we've said the punishment should be proportional in some way to the problem. It does seem that $30 million is not proportional to the problem here when there's no evidence of prejudice.
I completely agree with you that what was going on in the opinion below was the size of the judgment. Because I don't think that the actual rule announced in the order is one that could be supported. So the question then becomes, what do you make of the size of that judgment? We've got conflicting evidence in the record about the cause of Mr. Sims' injuries. He's obviously sustained catastrophic injuries. He's in a vegetative state. So the amount of any judgment, if it comes to that, is going to be huge. On the other hand, it can't be the case that the larger the judgment, the more you can ignore the proceedings below. There was a seven-month delay.
Powell, you're not addressing the question I asked.
Okay.
It may be that it would be within the district court's discretion to enter a $30 million default judgment here.
Right.
The question I'm asking is why it is not within the district court's discretion to conclude that that is not appropriate. We normally say that the entry of default judgments, that there are two propositions. One, the district judge has discretion about how much to tolerate. And two, that when deciding to do that, the judge should make some kind of apportionment between the remedy and the wrong.
Right.
And both of those seem to cut in favor of the district court's discretion. So I'm asking why the district court has so overstepped its discretion in thinking that $30 million is too big a penalty for this that we have to reverse. It's, right?
Had, in fact, the district court relied explicitly on the amount of the judgment, we might be in a different position. But the district court explicitly relied here on a lack of good cause or good cause and quick action on the part of the defendant. And I think that was clearly error. If the case goes back and the district court is in the position of having to consider whether if the size of the judgment is something that the court would be willing to rely on explicitly as the basis for this, for its decision, perhaps that would be a different case, but it's not the order that this court, the district court issued here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Rebell. Mr. Parker.
Please, the court.
I must say, I don't understand your position at all. You seem to want to put your client's head on the chopping block and ask us to swing. Why don't you first not only urge us to affirm, but second, stay as far away from this litigation as you can?
I can answer that with a two-part answer. First of all, we certainly would urge you to affirm.
Although you're busily urging us to dismiss for want of jurisdiction.
Well, the point is that your consideration of the merits of the district court's order vacating the entry of default at all puts my client at risk of a whopping judgment. And we think that if the case were remanded, as we would have urged, it actually wouldn't be here, I don't think, if we had been allowed to intervene.
If this case is remanded, or we do anything other than affirm, the settlement goes, and your client is now at risk of a $30 million award because your client is responsible for all this problem.
Well, I certainly am not in a position to concede that in this forum.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be wise to deny it either.
And you'll note that I haven't. In any event, Your Honor, what we're talking about here is trying to manage our risk. And the risk that is presented by this court's consideration of this order vacating the entry of default is a very substantial one to us. If instead the case goes back to the district court, or if it had never gotten here in the first place, which is what we think would have happened if we had been allowed to intervene, then there's three things that can happen, and two of them are good for us. It can be tried, in which case the EGA may end up suffering a judgment anyhow, in which case the plaintiff will have gotten all the relief they ever wanted to get against us, so we're frankly off the hook. Or if the case goes back and the parties have to face the prospect of trial, I fully expect there'll be additional settlement negotiations as there have been prior to the case getting here. And as the district court noted in its order, we participated fully in those settlement negotiations and intend to continue to do so. So the way we look at it, there's two out of three possibilities that end up good for us if the case is remanded or if the case had never gotten here to start with. And I don't think the case would be here if we had been allowed to intervene. The whole reason we're here is because we weren't given an opportunity to try to convince the district court that this was an improper invocation of the Rule 68 offer of judgment procedure.
Counsel, if I could ask a preliminary question before you get into that argument. What is your client, Meadowbrook Risk Management's, relationship to EGA products?
Meadowbrook, well, it doesn't have a direct relationship with EGA products, Your Honor.
Well, then why are you here?
Meadowbrook Risk Management, well, basically we're here because this settlement agreement puts us squarely in the target zone.
If you have no relationship to the insured, then why would that be the case?
I think that if you ask Dean Rebell that question, she's going to say that, in fact, she does believe that there is a sufficient relationship between Meadowbrook Risk Management Limited and the plaintiffs in this case, or EGA in this case, to support a claim directly against Meadowbrook.
Well, is it the case that the agents' conduct, litigation conduct that is at issue here, those agents worked for a different corporate entity, Meadowbrook Inc., which was the insurance administrator for EGA products?
Now I understand your question. The reason that Meadowbrook Risk Management Limited is the proposed intervener in this case is because Meadowbrook Risk Management Limited is the only entity that had a contractual relationship with North American Manufacturers Insurance Company, the liability insurer for EGA. We had a service agreement with NAMIC, under the terms of which we adjusted certain types of insurance. We acted as a claims handling agent for NAMIC. and NAMIC insured EGA.
But now, the claims handling agents whose conduct is at issue here worked for a different corporate entity, as I understand it, or is that not the case?
It was a related corporate entity, and from time to time it's clear that North American or our client, Meadowbrook Risk Management Limited, borrowed employees. It's a Bahamas corporation, but the claim was adjusted in Michigan. So we borrowed employees from our parent company to perform certain of the claims handling activities. But the contractual relationship existed between NAMIC and Meadowbrook Risk Management Limited. And that's why Meadowbrook Risk Management Limited is the proposed intervener here, because it is contractually on the hook with respect to NAMIC. Now, the reason that we think that the district court would have not entered this Rule 68 judgment is because we would have urged to the district court that, in fact, this was not a Rule 68 offer of judgment. Simply slapping that label on it and saying it's a Rule 68 offer of judgment.
What difference does it make whether it was Rule 68 or not, since both parties accept it? Rule 68 is a cram-down provision. It says if you don't accept something, then you pay costs. But since both parties agree to this judgment, what difference does it make whether Rule 68 would have allowed a cram down of costs?
Well, Rule 68 contemplates the entry of a final judgment, and it's only from a final judgment, of course, that the parties can appeal. And,
yes,
and that's why the presence
has anything to do with Rule 68. Whether this judgment is final or not depends on its terms, not on whether it was produced by Rule 68 as opposed to something else.
I certainly don't disagree with that, Your Honor. And what we would have urged the district court is that
the Rule 68 offer is totally irrelevant.
What we would have urged the district court is, the only reason I mention is because that's how the parties characterized it.
Yeah, but your brief goes on about this, and if you don't have any reason why it's relevant, it's difficult to see why you addressed it at length.
What we would have urged the district court is that this settlement agreement, which is what it is, cannot produce a final judgment because of its terms.
Why not?
It can't produce a final judgment because
a criminal defendant pleads guilty with reserving the right to appeal the order denying the motion to suppress. And if we affirm, the case is over, and if we reverse, it goes back for trial on the merits. I think that's a final judgment.
I believe, I'm not a criminal lawyer, but I believe that there is a specific provision in the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure that permits that.
There's a provision in Rule 11, but Rule 11 doesn't determine appellate jurisdiction. But we hear those appeals all the time. They're heard under a statute that depends on a final judgment. This judgment is basically, as far as I can see, the civil analog of a conditional plea in criminal procedure. And if the conditional plea in criminal procedure produces a final judgment, I don't see why this is less final.
The only problem with that analogy that I see, Your Honor, is that in this particular case, you have the party who, in whose favor judgment was entered, who was actually doing the appealing, as opposed to the party who suffered a judgment of conviction in the criminal context.
Why would that be relevant?
Because the basic rule,
the plaintiff wants more, right? Plaintiff goes to a trial and the jury awards $1 million. The plaintiff can appeal and say, I'm entitled to $2 million. The fact that you won something doesn't mean that you're not entitled to appeal. That's what's going on here. The plaintiff won $700,000 and appeals in quest of more. Perfectly normal in federal practice.
Perfectly normal when the plaintiff has suffered, has gone through a trial and been determined to only have entitlement to the $700,000 because of, for example, a partial summary judgment that was entered limiting damages or the failure of the district court to admit certain evidence of damages. That's a completely different situation than is posed by this case, where a party essentially agrees that I'll take this amount of money, and in some circumstances, I'll be satisfied with this amount of money.
I'm not satisfied with this amount of money.
They are if this court affirms, of course. They've said they are. But I think even more to the point, with respect to the finality of the judgment, what's contemplated here is that, again, there's three dispositions that you can make You can affirm, you can reverse, or you can decide that you don't have jurisdiction. And in two out of those three cases, we go back to the district court for more adversary proceedings. The case that we cited from the Third Circuit in our brief, the Verzilli versus Flexon case, very close. It didn't, Rule 68 wasn't implicated there, but it was a consent judgment, very much like this case. The holding there was that there was that was not a final judgment. The Union Oil case out of this circuit says basically a very similar thing.
Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Koss.
It pleases the court, counsel, or the plaintiff's counsel for Meadowbrook. I want to address the issue of the finality of the Rule 68 offer. That was mentioned briefly when counsel for plaintiff was.
Why do you think Rule 68 bears on appellate jurisdiction?
Only because that's.
Judgments that are final, Rule 68 offers are not judgments.
Yes, sir. Only because that is the vehicle that got us to this court, and that's the vehicle being challenged.
We've just been over that. It's totally irrelevant what vehicle gets to the judgment.
Chief Judge, I would say that the finality is the issue rather than Rule 68. Is this a final judgment? And EGA believes it is final. I want to identify the three options that have been mentioned. And that's why I'm referring to Rule 68, because that establishes what the parties are going to do. All three of these, the first two are the, if this court affirms, the case is over, obviously. If this court reverses, the litigation is over between these parties.
Well, how about if this court fails to rule on the merits of the appeal?
Yes, sir. Judge Cudahy, it was inserted specifically as a procedural walkthrough, because if this court were to take the position there is no jurisdiction, and this is a case where jurisdiction is going to be front and center because of the terms of the agreement, that third option identifies what the party's obligations are to do if the court doesn't rule and sends it back to the district court for lack of jurisdiction. It really identifies the procedure to put the money from the clerk's office back in the pocket of NAMIC, my client's insurer.
Doesn't that destroy finality, though? The judgment's not final if you send it back to do more things?
But, Your Honor, EGA believes that it would, then you don't have finality because you don't have jurisdiction. It's a circular argument. That was specifically included to give these two parties, the plaintiffs and EGA, the procedure to remove remove the money and to get back to square one. It is not an option of litigation under the agreement between EGA and the plaintiffs. Their litigation is complete unless the court finds that we shouldn't be here. And that's the area that the court must deal with. But that was inserted to allow the parties to move forward if they shouldn't be here, that is, if there's no jurisdiction. It is not, therefore, in EGA's position, evidence of lack of jurisdiction. It's simply the lawyering to provide that procedure to return to the district court. I want to then turn to what the intervening party has identified as its issue, and then conclude with the motion to set aside. It's EGA's position that there is no interest that is not protected for Meadowbrook. That is, Meadowbrook comes to the court saying, well, we want to intervene because we at Meadowbrook have an interest, we've identified it, and we're not protected. EGA is protecting Meadowbrook's interest. It has throughout this litigation. What it is not protecting is the hope, possibly, that EGA, if we go to litigation and EGA gets hit with a whopping verdict that's either close to or in excess of the 30 $1.2 million or $30.2 million. At that point in time, plaintiff's appeal from the default would evaporate, but my client would be left with that huge verdict. Meadowbrook would be completely off the hook then. And that may be a tactic, but Meadowbrook's not a party. They're not in litigation. They were a target, and they were in the crosshairs up until the October ruling by Judge Simon, which removed the default entry and set it aside. At that point in time, Meadowbrook's out of this picture, and EGA is, where it always was, is the target defendant in very serious damages litigation. After the discovery was complete, the parties, that is the plaintiff, EGA got together to fashion this type of an agreement to bring this to a conclusion. But Meadowbrook has never been in this litigation with an interest, and it won't be unless and until there is a reversal of the district court on the motion to set aside. At that point in time, it has an interest. And I would remind the court that the district court did, in fact, state in its order that Meadowbrook would have the opportunity, if you did reverse, Meadowbrook would have the opportunity to contest the damages at that time. But Meadowbrook's not been sued, and therefore to come in and to simply try to scotch the deal that's been brought between or has been concluded between the plaintiffs and EGA is simply not appropriate at this point in time. On the motion to set aside, EGA would disagree that the size was of the judgment, although it's relevant, that was controlling. Judge Simon does not say that. He devotes a paragraph to it, and I think in the last third of his order, and he says you can't ignore that size.
Why shouldn't Meadowbrook's negligence be imputed to EGA? That's the general rule outside of the federal courts, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, you were on the panel for Pretzel versus in Stouffer.
Counsel, it doesn't make any difference who writes the opinions and who's on the panel in any case.
And that's not the point, Your Honor. The point is that's still good law.
If it's not the point, then you shouldn't bring it up.
Yes, sir. And I apologize. Pretzel and Stouffer is still good law. There has been no law cited in contravention to that particular case. And I would say this as the problem if the court were to accept the theory that has been proffered by the plaintiffs on this. It would create, and this is from a litigation standpoint, one that's in the trenches, it would create for the attorneys and for the parties who have insurance a new layer of attorneys. That is, attorneys for the insured to watch over at the get-go the conduct of the attorneys and of the insurer, in this case, a third-party administrator. That would be the first problem. Second,
actually pretty common in large-stakes cases.
Well, it wouldn't be in large-stakes cases. There would be minions of law clerks in the firms that would be looking for the order and saying every time there was a problem with an insurer, the insured would therefore have an obligation, not just a cause of action, but would have an obligation to do something. And that's essentially what's been argued by the plaintiffs in this case. They're saying, sure, Meadowbrook's at fault. Sure, that's the big problem. But, Mr. Young, you are at fault too. That's what they argued to the district court. You should have done this. For Mr. Young, although aware of litigation, not a sophisticated litigant, for Mr. Young to hire an attorney or to somehow monitor more than he did would create, we believe, an undue burden. But I want to go to the facts of what Mr. Young did and very briefly sum them up. He always faxed in immediately any pleading he got. There were five pleadings received by EGA, and that counts the report and recommendation of January 13, 2003. He got the complaint and summons. He faxed that to Meadowbrook. Sometime at that same time, he got that order from Magistrate Judge Radovich for a status conference. He faxed that to Meadowbrook. A month delay, The next thing he got was another summons and complaint. He did not send that in. He looked at it. He testified, and he said it was identical. He's had other cases where multiple complaints were served on the company, and he didn't feel he needed to fax that forward. The fourth document that he got was the motion by the plaintiffs, or the request by the plaintiffs, that the clerk enter default. That document was not followed by a default to Dave Young or anyone at EGA. They had never gotten, there were two defaults, they didn't get either one of them.
Document seems to me to be the one that's suspect, though. That's not a document that he routinely received in connection with these lawsuits.
I can only tell you what he testified to, Your Honor. Number one, he immediately faxed it, and there was the form of order, it was a form of order not signed. And number two, he followed that up to see if anything was being done by Meadowbrook's agent at the time, which was not, by the way, the usual agent. And I say that because in the briefs there's some allegations of or references by the plaintiffs to maybe something being done intentionally. That's not the case, at least from the perspective of the record. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Ms. Rebell, we'll give you an extra minute for rebuttal if you have anything further.
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Then the case is taken under advisement.